There are two roads to Torkertown. One, the shorter and more direct route, lead across a barren upland moor, and the other, which is much longer, winds its tortuous way in and out among the hummocks and quagmires of the swamps, skirting the low hills to the east. It was a dangerous and tedious trail, so Solomon Kane halted in amazement when a breathless youth from the village he had just left overtook him and implored him for God's sake to take the swamp road. The swamp road? Kane stared at the boy. He was a tall, gaunt man, was Solomon Kane. His darkly pallid face and deep, brooding eyes made more somber by the drab, puritanical garb he affected. Yes, sir. 'Tis far safer, the youngster answered to his surprised exclamation.
HPPodcraft.com.
Life is a swamp road. I want to ride it all night long.
The youngster shook his head wearily. I know not the song you reference, Solomon Kane, but you should not ride that swamp road all night long, sir.
I feel a bit ashamed to have awakened the specter of Tom Cochran.
The specter? What have you done, man?
That was the spirit best left at rest.
That's what they say, yeah.
And just to be clear, he is alive. He's not dead.
Oh, okay.
We are in the midst of Thulai.
Yeah.
All Robert E. Howard all month.
Chicken wings with a side of Thew cheese dressing. Delicious.
That was a stretch.
I don't mind.
A delightful one. What you heard at the top was the beginning of the Solomon Kane story, Skulls in the Stars. We've never covered a Solomon Kane story before.
Mm-mm.
As it's a bit off of our beaten path, it's more pulp than weird, but we figured, why not?
But this one fits. This story was recommended by our reader today, Lyle Erickson, who's played lots of groovy music for us, but actually has not read on the show yet, so glad to have him on. I said, hey, let me know if there are any Robert E. Howard stories you like that you want to do. And he said, I think I remember one where Solomon Kane punches a ghost.
Yeah.
I said, stop right there. You had me at Solomon Kane punches a ghost. I love it. That will fit. And Lyle is, of course, one of the members of Pitch Black Manor.
Yeah.
You know, in the last show, some people were confused. I talked about the band as if I wasn't in it. And that was just because I'm a fan as well. So sometimes I lapse into that. It wasn't because I didn't get kicked out. If you hear that, it's a lie. It's not true. It's
strange you brought that up because I haven't heard that.
But we are here at almost hour zero. That Pitch Black Manor album, Monster Classics, is dropping soon. I played on it, whether they like it or not. And if you want to be in the know about this album, please email us at pitchblackmanor@gmail.com. And we'll get you on the mailing list, let you know about all the stuff that's coming out. Thank you, Lyle, for reading.
There are about 9 Solomon Kane stories. The first is Red Shadows, published in August of 1928 in Weird Tales. The story came out next in January of 1929. Howard, if you recall, was born in 1906, so he's only 23 years old when this thing came out.
Yeah.
And I was such a loser at 23 years old.
And no.
This guy was making magic.
You don't think at 23 you could have written about a Puritan punching a ghost? That was beyond your powers at that time?
In such a way, it was. Solomon Kane is a bit different than Conan. He's tall and gaunt. He's a Puritan with the hat and the buckle and all that nonsense.
Nonsense? I always liked that look. I think it's kind of cool. Thanksgiving chic, you know? I was always happy when that stuff came out around the holiday. I like shoe buckles so much. Swear to God, to this day, I won't buy dress shoes that don't have buckles on them. I don't like laces. Gotta be buckle shoes, square toes, and they have to come with a musket. No, not that. It's true, though. I do wear shoes like that. Do you remember a cartoon, though? I was going to ask you this, where there was like this Puritan guy in space and he had a laser musket and it was called Laser Balls.
What?
Do you remember that?
No.
I don't know if it was a real thing. I just thought maybe if I threw that out there, you'd go, yeah, I remember that. And then you could tell me where to watch it.
I think that might have been a dream you had.
No, I have no memory of it. I just really hoped it existed. Because I was taking a chance there and thinking maybe you would say, oh, yeah, I've seen Laser Balls. You can catch it on Netflix. What a result that would be.
That would have been great. Yeah, but no, I'm sorry to say that your fishing has caught you not.
Well, I went into it with courage, but it turns out I was a fool. What about Solomon Kane, though? He doesn't have a musket.
He's flintlock pistols. And a rapier and a dagger. And he travels around Europe and Africa, which I was surprised about, but I guess he has a lot of adventures in Africa. Yeah. He's all about fighting Satan and evil, but he seems to be flexible on his ethics about how he does his Satan fighting. But like Conan, he is a badass that knows no fear.
Yeah, for a bit there, I was kind of thinking, this is the first one I've read of Solomon Kane, actually, personally, too. I don't... know if I've... I think this is it. I figured out this guy's pretty much just like Conan with shoe buckles. But in the end, he showed some remorse and emotion.
Oh, yeah.
There was a human touch to it that definitely isn't there in Conan. So I liked it. Let's talk about the story.
Yeah, let's do it. It begins with Kane walking to a town called Horkertown.
That can't be the real name of the place. It sounds kind of pejorative, you know? Like, that's like calling Cincinnati Tweaker Town. I figure this place is probably called Forest Hills, but the people from the swamp are like, ugh, a bunch of torkers live up there.
Now, on his way, the road splits into two different directions. The shortest way is over the moors, but the long way is through the swamp.
And Robert Frost is there peeing his name into the snow. Oddly.
So, of course, he begins to head up through the moors, and this kid comes running up behind him from the village that he was just at and says, hey, man, don't go through the moors. They're not safe. Go through the swamp. And the kid says that there are quagmires and stuff up on the moor. Go through the swamp. Kane says, the whole journey through the moor would take a couple of hours. If I go in the swamp, it's going to take me all night. And the boy tells him that people have been killed up there traveling at night on the moor. The boy says that if you come back to town, then you can take the swamp road. There's this guy, old Ezra. He lets people stay in his place. He's cool. He's a miser, but he'll put you up for the night.
Well, and then the boy rattles off one sentence. Or to explain all this, it's like one sentence of crazy exposition that's presented as dialogue. He says, there are no houses at all upon the moor, while in the swamp there is the house of old Ezra, who lives there all alone since his maniac cousin Gideon wandered off and died in the swamp and was never found. And old Ezra, though a miser, would not refuse you lodging should you decide to stop until morning. I'm 10!
Yeah, that's a really long sentence.
It's got a lot of information in it.
Sure does. Kane is like, well, why didn't people in town warn me about this? And the boy says, people don't like to talk about such things because it can bring evil onto you.
Yeah.
Kane says, what is it that threatens me and why should I go miles out of my way to risk the bogs and mires? And the kid says, well, for over a year now, people have been getting murdered horribly by something up on the moors.
It says, late farers have heard terrible laughter far out on the fen, and men have heard the horrid shrieks of its victims.
And then we get a little insight into Kane here. It says, far back in Kane's gloomy eyes, a scintillant light had begun to glimmer like a witch's torch glinting under fathoms of cold gray ice. His blood quickened. Adventure. The lure of life risk and drama. Not that Kane recognized his sensations as such. He sincerely considered that he voiced his real feelings when he said, these things be deeds of some power of evil. The lords of darkness have laid a curse upon the country. A strong man is needed to combat Satan and his might. Therefore I go, who have defied him many a time. So Solomon Kane's a thrill seeker, yeah. But he's convinced himself that he's doing God's work.
I ride this roller coaster for God.
And the kid, he's got one last thing to say. He says, the corpses of the victims are bruised and torn, sir.
Wait, bruised? I don't know if I much care for bruises. That's the thing that scares him.
Well, I just think he's describing what this attack is going to be like, so maybe he can somehow anticipate it, I guess.
Torn would be the thing I'd be worried about. But
so Kane goes up into the moors just as the sun is setting. The moon began to rise, lean and haggard, like a skull among the stars. As he walks, Kane hears sounds, an echo, and then an evil laugh. He was not afraid, but for a second, he was almost unnerved. That sounds to me like sleeping? No, I was just resting my eyes.
Yeah. For a minute, I might have been a little kind of almost scared, but no. I like.
Yeah, no, I was never scared. I was unnerved, but I wasn't
maybe
scared.
I was approaching unnerved. The laughter continued, growing louder, as did the screams. Then sounded faintly the drum of frantic human feet. Kane broke into a run. Some human was being hunted to death out there on the fen, and by what manner of horror God only knew. This stuff is great. The sound of the flying feet halted abruptly and the screaming rose unbearably, mingled with other sounds, unnameable and hideous. Evidently, the man had been overtaken, and Kane, his flesh crawling, visualized some ghastly fiend of the darkness crouching on the back of its victim, crouching and tearing. Yeah.
Oof. Oh, man. So Kane runs into action. By the time he gets to the source, the screams have become weak gurgling. The moon is up in the sky, and Kane can see a horribly mutilated body.
Yeah, it says a thing that had once been a man, a gore-covered, frightful thing that fell at Kane's feet and writhed and groveled and raised its terrible face to the rising moon and gibbered and yammered and fell down again and died in its own blood. He uses yammering in the story a lot. And not to describe somebody who's just talking too much. It's always some kind of horrific connotation, and I like it. It's a good word.
Kane deduces that this was just some wayfarer, some guy traveling through the moor, probably didn't know about this legend.
But the sight of this gets to him and says he shuddered, a rare thing for him, who had seen the deeds of the Spanish Inquisition and the Witch Finders. Ooh, that made me want to read more Cain. When did he come up against the Inquisition? I want to know. But then he senses he's not alone as he looks down on the victim, and he pulls out his pistol, waiting.
The moonlight spread like a lake of pale blood over the moor. The shadows melted, and Cain saw. At first, he thought it only a shadow of mist, a wisp of moor fog that swayed in the tall grass before him. He gazed. More illusion, he thought. Then the thing began to take on shape, vague and indistinct. Two hideous eyes flamed at him. Eyes which held all the stark horror which has been the heritage of man since the fearful dawn ages. Eyes frightful and insane, with an insanity transcending earthly insanity. The form of the thing was misty and vague, a brain-shattering travesty on the human form, like, yet horribly unlike. The grass and bushes beyond showed clearly through it.
It says Cain felt the blood pound in his temples, yet he was cold as ice. And then at that point, the youth runs up. Sir, I still don't understand what song you're referencing. But Cain is confused how such an unstable being as that which wavered before him could harm a man in a physical way was more than he could understand. Yet the red horror at his feet gave mute testimony that the fiend could act with terrible material effect. So Cain is kind of going through some ghost theory in his head. You know, if it can hurt people materially... What was it? Dolomite said, if you see a ghost, you stab.
The ancient teachings of Dolomite. The ghostly thing laughs evilly, and Cain pulls out a pistol and he shoots it, but no effect. A maniacal yell of rage and mockery answered the report, and the thing came at him like a flying sheet of smoke, long, shadowy arms stretched to drag him down.
Cain, moving with the dynamic speed of a famished wolf, fired the second pistol with as little effect. Snatched his long rapier from its sheath and thrust into the center of the misty attacker. The blade sang as it passed clear through, encountering no solid resistance, and Cain felt icy fingers grip his limbs, bestial talons tear his garments and the skin beneath. He dropped the useless sword and sought to grapple with his foe. It was like fighting a floating mist, a flying shadow armed with dagger-like claws. His savage blows met empty air. His leanly mighty arms, in whose grasp strong men had died, swept nothingness and clutched emptiness. Naught was solid or real save the flaying, ape-like fingers with their crooked talons and the crazy eyes which burned into the shuddering depths of his soul. Cain realized that he was in a desperate plight indeed. Already his garments hung in tatters, and he bled from a score of deep wounds. But he never flinched, and the thought of flight never entered his mind. He had never fled from a single foe, and had the thought occurred to him, he would have flushed with shame.
The speed of a famished wolf. It's pretty good, but it needed some more modification, I think, because I imagine a famished wolf might be a little lazy or whiny. I'm hungry. Yes, wolf, we're all hungry. If he just said it was like the speed of a famished wolf passing a sizzler.
There you go.
You know, then I know.
Yeah, that's it. That's it.
He's moving fast to get, you know, steak and some shrimp.
It's that salad bar, man.
So germy and delicious. You just said salad bar, and I felt instantly queasy.
So things are looking bad for Cain, but he feels death upon him, and he thinks, this is a thing of hate. It uses hate as a weapon. What abstract emotion can I use? And he actually says that. Mm-hmm. And he thinks, courage. And he thinks these thoughts of courage and power and strength and bravery, and somehow these thoughts give him purchase on this thing. This fight, I thought, was because Lyle described it as him punching a ghost. We don't really get that. It's kind of a sloppy tussle.
Right.
It says, Cain fought with his arms and his feet and his hands, and he was aware at last that the ghost began to give back before him, and the fearful laughter changed to screams of baffled fury. For man's only weapon is courage that flinches not from the gates of hell itself, and against such not even the legions of hell can stand.
Yeah, in fact, I think Lyle kind of buried the lead on this one, because it says he fought with his arms and his feet and his hands, so definitely he punched the ghost.
Yeah.
But he also kicked the ghost, and if he used his arms, probably a chokehold, too.
Elbow?
Or an elbow? All that stuff. This whole section kind of spun me out a bit. I was thinking, it is an abstract concept, you know, courage. What is it what is courage? I mean, I think it's just defined as doing something you're afraid of. I mean, I guess I think of it in terms of The Wizard of Oz and lines like, you know, there's a thin line between courage and stupidity, which I always thought was a little pat because there isn't really a line. It's not as if you're on either side of a line. There's just an outcome. Courage and stupidity, those things are only assigned in retrospect. If doing something you fear, there might be a very good reason to fear something.
Yeah, of course. Well, I think the difference between courage and stupidity, I think with courage, you're acknowledging fear, that you have fear and you're still doing the thing that you're doing. I think with stupidity, you're not actually afraid and you should be.
Yes. That's a good distinction. Let me offer an example here.
Okay, sure.
So I was in the Dresden Room one night with some friends. If I was there, it was probably some people from out of town. I don't necessarily remember, but they've got the singers Marty and Elaine there, and it's a good place to take people when they visit Los Angeles. So we're there, we're watching the lounge act, then suddenly everybody heard this huge splash, and a bunch of busboys kind of gathered around by the bathrooms, and water started coming out on the floor. I was fairly close, so I stood up, I said, what's going on? And I leaned around the corner, and there was just like a fire hose of water coming out of the pipe in the bathroom. And these guys are serving food and drinks. I mean, they didn't want to go in there and get wet. Nobody knew what to do, but the bathroom was kind of filling up. I had a couple of drinks, i.e. courage. So I said, you know what? I'm going to solve this for them. I said, I'll take care of it. And it was very heroic. I go towards the bathroom and they were like, no, sir, no. What are you doing?
Yeah.
Don't worry about it. I go in, just get blasted with the water. But I didn't care. Walked over, walked through it, leaned over. There's the little, you know, knob. I turned off the water. The stream stopped. Big round of applause. Marty and Elaine actually had stopped playing as this went on. So I had the moment in the movie where I came out and they started playing Staying Alive. It was amazing. Went over to the bar soaking wet. Huge hero. Free drinks all night. Now imagine if I'd gone over to that knob, turned it, and nothing had happened. Now, yes, there's a pipe that broke in the bathroom. There's also a drunken fool in there who's super wet and making this more difficult. It would have been so embarrassing.
No, I disagree. I think that you were still brave because you knew the consequences were if you go in there, you're going to get wet. Like, that's going to happen. And you realize, you know what? I can deal with that. Most people are like, I don't want to get wet. I can't go in there. You know, that's terrible. Yeah. You decided that I'm going to go in there. I'm going to get wet to see if I can fix this problem. And you did, and it worked out. Now, if you went in there and
and
it didn't work, I wouldn't think that you were an idiot. I would think you were awesome for going in there and trying. It's like in a war, if somebody has to fight and they get killed, they weren't being stupid. They knew that they could die fighting in that battle, and they were just like, I got to fight in it anyway.
Well, I'm glad you put it in those terms, because I kind of do feel like a veteran since that happened.
yeah, I can see that.
I mean, that was kind of a war for me.
A water war.
Laura, here's another example. You were present for this one.
Okay.
And this is a little more where, in saying things, it takes a little courage sometimes to make a joke, not knowing if it's going to land or not.
Yes.
So do you remember when we were at that Summit meeting? And Summit is a big Hollywood financier that makes movies. This was right before they were about to do Twilight with Lionsgate and make it, you know, that was kind of their big thing.
It was just after Mr. and Mrs. Smith came out.
That's right.
It was the following week, because I remember they were all riding high because it was the number one movie.
That's right. And that was their movie. And the producers of Twilight are in the room. We were at that long table. All these executives, Richard Kelly, director Donnie Darko on the speakerphone. We're talking about a script that these guys wanted to make. And they were super excited about it. Meeting goes great. I was nervous at first, but we both felt pretty relaxed. We're making jokes and stuff. They were giving us notes about the script. I think I might have talked about this before on the show, but they said, well, you know, I want some kind of thing to happen with the monster in the end. I don't know what, because the guy's sitting in this chair. And I said, before I could stop myself, I go, what if you pan up and the monster's just standing in the window jerking off? And then we cut to black. And there was a little bit of silence, and then everybody started laughing. And I felt this relief, because I said it before I like, forgot that we were in a business setting, because I would have made that joke to you, you know.
I would say that was stupidity, because it wasn't bravery. You did a thing without thinking about it and realizing what the repercussions of that thing could be. And
I guess I said it out loud while I was describing it, didn't I? Yeah.
So you weren't being brave, because if you were brave, you'd go, you know what? I could ruin this meeting. I could tank our whole thing, but I'm going to still say this joke anyway, because I think it's worth saying. That's not what happened. You were just blindly letting your lips lips.
Yeah, but let me ask you, though. If I did think it through, and when I think that this joke's really going to land, and it could screw things up, but I'm going to try it anyway.
Yeah.
And then it didn't land, and somebody in the room was like, tweeted out, I just went to a meeting in Hollywood, and some guy thought he was so funny, right in front of everybody, talking about jerking off. It made me super uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And then your career got canceled.
Yep.
Would you be like, well, at least you had courage? I have a feeling you'd be telling me I was pretty stupid, no matter what my reasoning was.
Yeah, I think...
That's why
I'm saying. It's still stupidity. I still think it's stupidity.
Now, let me be clear. I have no illusions that was courageous. It was stupidity. I agree with you. I guess it was just...
We're talking some philosophical ideas here. You know,
that's right.
This is cool. And Solomon Kane is bringing these to the forefront.
He is. That's why the story's pretty cool, to be honest.
It is.
I was thinking about that stuff.
So this creature is getting weaker and weaker until Kane, he's able to actually grab it and throw it. And then once it's on the ground, he leaps upon it. The monster's gibbering. It's saying all this crazy stuff. But when he gets close to it, it becomes comprehensible. And then it just says, and Kane knew.
It imparted frightful secrets and whisperings and yammerings and screaming silences. Gets beat down and then tells some secrets.
That's kind of cool.
Yeah, it was a really cool chapter.
And that's chapter 2, the second half of the story. We find ourselves at the house of Ezra the Miser.
Beautiful writing here. It says, old Ezra the Miser partook much of the quality of the swamp, for he was gnarled and bent and sullen. His fingers were like clutching parasitic plants, and his locks hung like drab moss above eyes trained to the murk of the swamplands. His eyes were like a dead man's, yet hinted of depths abysmal and loathsome as the dead lakes of the swamplands.
Yeah.
This is like a script for a Bernie Wrightson illustration out of Eerie or Creepy Comics, you know? He just really nails that feel. He does swamp work like no other.
So Kane approaches the house, all scratched up and bandaged. He is with local villagers.
Somewhat behind this man stood a number of villagers, is how you know that. It's one sentence.
So Kane asks Ezra where his cousin Gideon is, and Ezra tells him he got lost out in the swamp.
He's pretty callous about it. Yeah, he goes, he wandered away into the swamp and never came back. No doubt he lost his way and was set upon by wolves or died in a quagmire or was struck by an adder. You know, whatever. Who cares? It feels like that was his attitude that very night. It's about an hour late. Whatever, he probably, you know, got struck by an adder. Just writes him off.
He asks Ezra how long ago this happened, and Ezra says, it was just over a year ago. And then Kane brings up that people have been dying up on the moor for just over a year.
Hark ye, Ezra the Miser. Soon after your cousin's disappearance, a countryman was set upon by some unknown fiend. All this happened at the same time. So he's making connections. But do you think the villagers were a little embarrassed when Kane actually called him Ezra the Miser? I have a feeling that's a little behind the back action. That's not his job. It's not like Ezra the Cobbler.
No.
That's just shit talk. That's like, hello, are you Jonathan, he who smells like soup or something? I never should have told him that.
So Kane tells him about what he encountered last night. And Ezra's like, yeah, wow, that's terrible, man. And Kane tells him how he defeated it. And then when he did defeat it, it told him the truth. Ezra starts to get nervous and he goes, why are you telling me this?
Yeah, it's like you're dating somebody and find out they met your ex-girlfriend. Like, wait, well, you talked to her? You didn't tell her I called her a miser, did you? Listen, she's crazy. You can't believe anything she tells you. Now, Kane says, I listened to the ghost. We had a fight. We made up. Things got real deep. We're bros now. I went back and I told the villagers what's up and we're all pretty upset.
So Kane says, now I know how to get rid of this thing. And you're going to come with us up to the rotting oak on the moors. And the villagers just grab Ezra at that point, and then they drag him up to the moors.
This would be a great story for kids, because it teaches you courage. It teaches you not to judge a ghost by its cover.
That old saying.
Yeah.
Just as the sun is setting, they all get to the old oak tree on the moor, and Ezra is freaking out. Kane says, over a year ago, you, fearing your insane cousin Gideon would tell men of your cruelties to him, brought him away from the swamp by the very trail by which we came and murdered him in the night. Hmm. So what was he doing to Gideon?
Just be a beating him, probably. Treating him unfairly. I mean, again, the story, maybe it's not totally appropriate for kids, but it does have some good values in it, and I think it's showing how mental health is a community issue. And you can't tolerate cruelty towards folks who have these difficulties.
Oh, right.
There's an element here where I think that obviously these villagers are upset because this guy caused an insane ghost to be killing people, and they're afraid of that.
Yeah.
But I do feel like there's an element to it where when they figured out what it was after Kane told him that they were like, he was beating up on Gideon because the kid knew who Gideon was.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
You know, I just imagine that this really made them mad because they had an understanding that Gideon doesn't deserve that kind of treatment because he's got some issues.
Right.
And so I was a little heartened. These are like, this is like an angry mob that's kind of dispensing some real justice, you know?
Yeah.
I thought that was cool.
So Ezra says, you can't prove any of this, which is something somebody guilty always says. It's not like, I didn't do it. It's, you can't prove it. So Kane tells one of the youngsters to climb up into the tree and look inside, and the guy pulls out a human skull that has a cleft in it.
Yeah, I read that a couple times. I thought, did he have it in a hollowed up tree? But it doesn't really say. He just pulled it down. So, it says the youth clambered up the rotting bole and from a crevice high up dragged something that fell with a clatter at the feet of the miser. So I just thought it was interesting. He hid the body up in a tree. Not particularly inside of it. I think he just draped it over up there. So, I mean, that's novel. Yeah. What did he think would happen? The birds will take care of it.
Could be, yeah. Well, moors are pretty rocky. There's not a lot of soil up on a moor, so it's really hard to bury things up there.
He just solved it for me.
Ezra calls Cain Satan. Hmm. And Cain, he ain't bothered. He tells them that the thing he fought was Gideon's ghost, and that this ghost was so full of rage and desire for revenge that he can't tell one person from another. So when he was killing all these people, he thought he was killing Ezra.
Yeah.
But he was just killing innocent people. But it's Ezra that he wants to kill. And then once he does kill Ezra, he'll move on to the next world and not bother anybody anymore.
What's kind of interesting is that Ezra knew that his murder might lead to a ghost. Like, he actually knew that. Mm-hmm. And that's why he hid the body up on the moors instead of the swamp, so that Gideon would be confused and not be able to find him. And I know that it's likely due to other things going on in the world, but it made me really sad. Like, that broke my heart that that ghost is wandering around and doesn't know where home is.
Yeah.
I felt really sad for Gideon.
Aww.
He took advantage of his confusion just to make his life harder. I don't know. Got to.
Yeah. I mean, in getting rid of a person in a swamp is a real easy thing to do, but he knew that there's a good chance that he might come back as a ghost, so he's like, I can't have him anywhere around where I live because I don't want him coming to get me.
You would think that an awareness that bad deeds lead to ghosts would actually make you a more moral person.
Yeah, but just, I guess, for Ezra, he's more conniving.
Yeah.
So Cain says, "Not but your death will lay that ghost. A hard thing it is to sentence a man to death in cold blood in such a manner as I have in mind, but you must die that others may live, and God knoweth you deserve death. You shall not die by noose, bullet, or sword, but by the talons of him you slew, for naught else will satiate him."
You know, I'm not personally a supporter of capital punishment, but if it were done by the ghosts of victims...
Yes. Well, there you go.
Yeah, that might change my politics.
So Ezra freaks out and begs them just to kill him right then and there. He says, "Burn me at the stake, but don't let the ghost get me." So they tie him to the tree, but Cain says, "Loosen the bonds. It is better to meet death free and unshackled than bound like a sacrifice." They're loosening up his ropes so that when they leave, he can try and get out of them and run across the boars. They leave Ezra there, and then they walk away, and they hear Ezra screaming.
This is actually the exact ending to the movie Training Day. If you recall, Ethan Hawke leaves, you know, the abusive cop Denzel Washington to the people in the neighborhood that he's been abusing and drives away.
And they
get justice. He gets justice at the hands of those he's been persecuting.
Oh, yeah.
That's kind of the same thing. But Ezra screams, "Death, death. There are skulls in the stars." So boom, there's your title. Maybe he was just seeing double vision.
Yeah, why is there multiple skulls?
I don't know. Something that, it's an effect of the ghost, I guess.
Was one of the skulls the moon and the other skull maybe the ghost?
I don't know.
It sounds cool. I think it's probably
the
reason why.
It does. That's the issue. Yeah.
Now here, Cain is surprisingly merciful, and he says, "Life was good to him, though he was gnarled and churlish and evil. Mayhap God has a place for such souls where fire and sacrifice may cleanse them of their dross, as fire cleanses a forest of fungus things. Yet my heart is heavy within me."
Yeah, he takes on a feeling of burden for what he's done and even says, you know, I hope God rehabilitates people.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of just punishing them, which I thought was an interesting notion. Certainly, he should feel regretful if he was the one who performed this execution, if he made a decision and there was a beheading or a hanging or something like that. But given that it was supernatural revenge, it's even cooler that this makes him feel terrible and responsible.
He's a very different character than Conan.
Yeah, he is. Yeah, yeah. He's carrying the weight of this decision with him.
So they walk on as night falls and something moves across the land, but then they have one last look back.
Nothing could be seen. The moor was an ocean of shadows, and the tall grass about them bent in long waves before the faint wind, breaking the deathly stillness with breathless murmurings. Then far away the red disk of the moon rose over the fen, and for an instant a grim silhouette was etched blackly against it. A shape came flying across the face of the moon, a bent, grotesque thing whose feet seemed scarcely to touch the earth. And close behind came a thing like a flying shadow, a nameless, shapeless horror. A moment the racing twain stood out boldly against the moon. Then they merged into one unnameable, formless mass and vanished in the shadows. Far across the fen sounded a single shriek of terrible laughter.
And that's the end of the story.
That is the sweet vengeance of the ghost. Yeah,
but a bit melancholy. You know, it's like kind of sad. Sad that all that Gideon had to die, and sad that this guy had to be murdered in such a horrible way. And it was all sad. I mean, would you say that Gideon was a person of high quality?
The ghost? Gideon?
Yeah. Do you think he's better than Ezra? Whoa, it was good living with you. Whoa,
sir,
whoa.
Sir, again, I have no idea what you're talking about. I'm 10.
That was a good setup. I'm sorry. I didn't. You would think I would have a better sense of that given the amount of... kind of dad jokes I make. I was confused the other day because Heather was wearing this shirt I really liked, and I said, "Man, that shirt's really dad." She said, "What are you talking about?" I was like, "You know, cool, fine." She was like, "What?" I said, "Well, people keep writing and saying I make these dad jokes."
Oh boy!
She was like, yeah. "That was somehow the daddest of them all." I was like, "I agree, thanks."
You know, who don't really deserve some dad jokes are
who?
The patrons of our show, the people that support and are part of our family, and without them, you and I would not continue to be making these dad jokes.
That's so true. They show courage because they come and listen even though they know they're going to be abused with some groaners. They know it.
And I would first of all like to thank Egg Sandwich.
Yeah, both the person and the item. Anything involved with an egg sandwich, especially this patron. I also want to thank Michael Downey.
I want to thank Connie McBee.
I'd like to thank Eric Steiner.
Michael Ramos, thank you.
Kenton Riley Nisbet Fast, thank you so much.
I'd like to thank Brian.
Alexander Shendy, thank you.
Sean Kessler, thank you so much.
And John B. Young, you never get old. Thanks for being a patron. I also want to thank our reader today, Lyle Erickson. I don't have a track to play from the album this week, but the album's going to be out very soon. If you want to be alerted as soon as it drops, shoot me an email, pitchblackmanor@gmail.com, and you will be in the know. We've got another Robert E. Howard coming up next week. We actually haven't decided what it is yet, so as soon as we know that, we'll put it in the show notes. But thanks, everybody, for tuning in. We'll be back next week with more of that. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast.
At hppodcraft.com.
hppodcraft.com.